Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by Ian Dark and John Rawling. Gents, it's always a pleasure, and today we're talking about none other than the Hitman, Ricky the Hitman Hatton, one of England's finest and one of Britain's most popular, not just fighters of all time, but boxers of all time. You both covered him extensively. Ian, let's kick off with you. What made Ricky Mr. Popular?
He just had that feeling of a guy that would be great fun having a drink with down the pub. He had all those little one-liners, but above that, when he got in the ring, apart from being a Mr. Popularity and a nice guy out of there, when he got in the ring, he was exciting. It was a marquee style. I remember the first time we covered him, we knew about what he'd done as an amateur. And we thought, let's stick around. I think he was last on. It was like Wigan or Widnes or somewhere. I can't remember. It was past midnight. Everybody'd gone home. In comes Ricky Hatton to fight in a deserted arena, last on the bill. It was worth just waiting for. Obviously, he wasn't in with anybody particularly good, but there was something about the vibe he gave off that you thought, yeah, I think this is probably the seeds of a story here.
Yeah, so Ricky told me about this story. So that was his debut in Widnes, and I think it was on a Robin Reed bill. And he fought Colin McCauley, who was 8-48-3 at the time. And yeah, Ricky, as Ricky tells it, people were packing up and getting ready to go, and, you know, TV were packing up. But a few of you diehards remained. I mean, obviously, Ricky told me all these stories for when I wrote his book with him, War and Peace. But it's interesting that you guys had that you particularly stuck around, Ian, because obviously Ricky thought everyone had legged it and left an empty
building. Wanted to go home. We wanted to go back to the hotel and have a drink like we always did. You know, the main bit of the show, we were off the air. There was no reason to stay except some kind of perverted professional integrity, yeah. I guess.
How about you, John? When did you first see Ricky?
Well, the first time I saw him was on the undercard of Naz and Kevin Kelly. He went over there in his second pro fight and fought at Madison Square Garden. And I remember him from there, not so much about the fights, which I think, as far as I can remember, was, you know, nothing of any great note. He won, obviously, easily, but didn't, you know, it wasn't one to go down in the history books. But what I do remember is standing outside Madison Square Garden and thinking, what a great bloke this lad is. I think he'd have probably been with Billy Graham, his trainer. And there he was on Fifth Avenue, Seventh Avenue, is it, where Madison Square Garden is, staring up at the famous arena. And you could see the look in his face, the look in his eyes. It was one of, you know, sort of wonderment. He's looking at this thinking, God, am I really here in my second pro fight? He'd only have been 18 years old then, or possibly 19. And it was the right at the start of the journey. But he was so charming, as Ian says. I mean, he was like a fighting Bernard Manning. He'd got a little quick... He got a little line for everything, haven't he?
Yeah. I mean, it was all a great story, wasn't it? His dad was a Manchester City player and was managing him, you know, and he used to tell all those yarns about being a carpet fitter, helping out with the family carpet fitting business, and only he couldn't do it very well. So it was all kind of self-effacing. And there were stories of, you know, he'd go down after every fight and have a Guinness and a greasy spoon and drink way too much and put on too much weight between the fights, which probably wasn't very wise. But I tell you what, it endeared him to his fan base in Manchester. And I think what they did very cleverly was they tapped into the, you know, he was a Manchester City fan, died in the war Manchester City fan. They tapped into that fan base at a pretty early point. So a lot of people, you know, all those people who filled the MEN Arena in Manchester, they weren't boxing fans. They were Manchester City football fans, and they wanted to go in and support this great lad who supported Manchester City like them and could fight.
And John, you mentioned Billy Graham there. Obviously, you would have been exposed to Billy with, you know, through the Carl Thompson days and the Champs Camp days and everything else, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Billy was a great character in his own right. He was somebody who, it's fair to say, he didn't tolerate fools and still doesn't. If he thought something was wrong or thought somebody was saying the wrong thing, he'd have absolutely no compunction about telling you exactly what he thought about you. But they were kind of a match made in heaven. You know, he was a bit of a rough diamond. Ricky came from the archetypal working class background, growing up on the Hattersley estate over in Hyde and in the pretty rough East End of Manchester. And yeah, he tapped into that fan base. And, you know, Ian talked about how he was the sort of man who lots of people think they'd have liked to have gone for a pint with down the pub. The fact of the matter is that he liked a pint so much, there were a hell of a lot of those fans who actually had a pint with him down the pub.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Billy there. I mean, they were best friends, weren't they? They were like brothers as well. They spent so much time together. And Billy knew Ricky inside out. He knew the keys, what needed to be said, when. He knew what Ricky had as a fighter, so he was good on the strategy as well. But he was an unusual bloke, though. I mean, I think at one stage, I remember he said he was sharing his flat with a monkey and an iguana. And he said it was all going well, but then the iguana turned on the monkey. So that was the end of that arrangement. I mean, the other thing was, he told me one day, I said, what are you going to be doing at the weekend then? He goes, oh, I'll go out and catch a few adders down on the moors. So he had this thing about snakes as well. I mean, I remember he looked at some case where Ricky's sparring in the gym, and in the case beside the ring was this like Californian golden snake. And he was looking at it and, that's a beautiful snake. As long as it stays in there, I'm fine.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, he had that back office at the Phoenix camp, didn't he? And it was basically a reptilry at the back. He had all sorts going on in there. And obviously, you know, I went and saw Billy at his home a couple of years ago, maybe a little bit longer. But, you know, he's moved so that he's more at one with nature. He's still all into his animals. And he had a spell with a house out in Atlanta so he could spend more time with the creepy crawlies, which is insane, because in boxing you spend enough time with creepy crawlies anyway. So John, obviously Ian touched upon this in a previous podcast, actually. I mean, in terms of technical ability, Ricky was right up there, but his style was suited for the pros, wasn't it? Which is why he turned over young.
Yeah, he got very disillusioned with the amateurs. He had these junior titles, and I think he did actually win the senior ABA, didn't he, at light welterweight? But he got a load of junior titles, but he got absolutely sawn off at the World Championships, amateur World Championships. He got to the semi-finals in 1996, was it? And he lost there. One of the judges gave an outrageous points decision against him, which counted overall bigger than those who voted for him. And consequently, he lost the fight and was totally disillusioned. There were words about how the judge had taken a bribe, et cetera, usual sort of twisted stuff, which seems to have gone on over the years in amateur boxing. But his style, because he only stands about 5'6" and a half, 5'7", and his idol, the way he wanted to fight, was in sort of the Roberto Duran type style, a classical infighter with hand speed, but with powerful body shots. And that's not the way that has traditionally ruled the roost in the amateur division. It's more sort of a jab and move and footwork and more of a, I don't know, a sort of a fencing match rather than a fighting brawl. And he reckoned that the amateur game wasn't playing to his strengths. And he always thought that he would turn over as a pro. And yeah, he turned pro at the age of 18 and he just had phenomenal success, didn't he? He worked his way through the undercard type fights in the early stages of his career, but it wasn't too long before he was topping the bill at the MEN and attracting fans absolutely by their thousands.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was 20,000 sellout every time, wasn't it, at the MEN Arena at a pretty early point in his career. I mean, what I found fascinating as a TV commentator is nearly everybody, you know, you think of Frank Bruno, who became a big star because he was on BBC One, terrestrial TV, Sports Night, you know, every Wednesday night when he was fighting. Ricky was only on Sky Sports. He was only on a satellite channel. I'd say he was the first star who hadn't been on terrestrial TV. He was on, he was, became a star on Sky, and because of his huge fan base in Manchester. And of course, you know, and the writers wrote about him, which was, you know, a key thing as well. He was getting good spreads in the paper. He wasn't just like some prospect somewhere who was coming through. Everybody was clued into the story. But, you know, John, I mean, he was much more than just a brawler, wasn't he? He
came, oh, yeah,
with educated pressure. He knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah, he was technically he was underrated, I think, by many people. There was a lot more to him than just going in there and, you know, flinging big hooks. It was educated pressure, and that carried him through. And I have to say as well, he was brilliantly matched, wasn't he? Because the WBU title, it didn't really count for a deal, did it? It was a kind of a manufactured title, but it was enough for the people who, as you said earlier, were not particularly real boxing fans. A lot of them were football fans. They were sort of swept along by the whole thing. So when he's going and fighting, well, the likes of, Freddie Pendleton, he had those excellent fights against Eamon McGee, Vince Phillips, Ben Tackey, these people. Yeah, good fighters, but not elite-level fighters. Yeah. But he came through the tests, and he was learning all the time. And I thought it was a terrific piece of matchmaking over those 3 years.
Yeah, he had a bit of trouble, didn't he, early on in the fight against Eamon McGee. And I remember that other bigger emergency he had. It was a fight we did off television pictures. We were in England. We didn't go to it. Against a guy called Kiroz in America, where he got a very bad cut in the fight. And it looked there as if he was going to lose his unbeaten record. And I think, when he came home, he said, I was more or less fighting blind. And he had to get the job done pretty quickly. Otherwise, the cut would have stopped him. So there was a little emergency along the way in terms of just keeping the unbeaten record. But yeah, I mean, I think there were 15 defenses of that, how can we put it, lightly regarded WBU title. I mean,
what was the fella called who ran the WBU? At one stage was
John Robinson, wasn't it?
Who was it?
John Robinson.
That's the one. Reckoned to be the largest man in Great Britain at one time. And Frank Warren used
Norfolk,
to say,
he ran it from a house in Norfolk.
Frank Warren used to say WBU stood for the world's biggest underpants.
Ian, you mentioned the cut there. You're the first one to touch upon that hot word with Ricky in his early career, because two fights after Kiroz, he had that absolute bloodbath with John Thaxton in Wembley.
Yeah.
Do you remember how much talk there was about Ricky and his cuts at the start, and people thinking that he's not going to get beyond British level because his eyes aren't going to hold up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was, you know, if you want to go way back, you know, Alan Minter, Henry Cooper, you know, they were big problems with cuts. And because he fought in the zone so much and fought on the inside, you know, throwing those wicked hooks to the body, there was always the danger that that was going to happen. And of course, some of his opponents, to try to throw him and to try to even up the score a little bit, were quite free with the head as well. So yeah, that was a worry. But I think in the end, you know, the 1 minute wonders, I think he got Mick Williamson in the corner, didn't he? It was like, you know, a bit of a special guy with the cuts, and that helped it not become the big problem going forward that some people thought at the time it might be.
Well, there was also there was a point in his career where I think he had surgery, and I think they found that from an earlier cut that there was still a wedge of Vaseline under there. And so every time that was hit, it still just burst open. So I think they found when they were having the procedures that they had to clean out all the crap that had been sewed in there when he had stitches previously. Sorry, John, you were going to say about Mick the Rub.
Well, yeah, I was just going to say Mick did an extraordinary job with him for a long, long time, didn't he? I mean, Mick was very, very talented at that particular specialist job. Many tried to do it, but I don't think many did it much better than Mick. I remember once I had an argument with a pavement which I lost, and I turned up at a fight with this huge sort of bandage around my head, which mercifully I wasn't on camera that day because I would have taken a fearful ribbing. And I remember Mick saying to me, "John, if you ever have a problem like that again, don't mess around going down to A&E. Just come and see me. I could sort you out."
Get his adrenaline and swabs out.
Did the pavement, yeah. The pavement stopped you in the seventh round, didn't it, I think?
the pavement had a great chin. I was never going to take it out.
Yeah, very world ranked the pavement was.
By the WBU, of course. Yeah. Ian, let me ask you this. When what was the buzz like early on with Ricky on Sky? I mean, when did you think that these guys are really putting their weight behind it? Because like you said, the first one wasn't even recorded. So at what point do you think that they think they've got a world prospect on their hands?
Oh, from a very early point. I think we showed nearly all his fights. I mean, I think the Kiros one came along a little bit later. That wasn't the first one we actually put out. We covered fights in Britain of him. I mean, the very fact that we were doing that, you know, going into a studio in the middle of the night to bring you Ricky Hatton from America, just shows you. Yeah, there was a good deal of excitement around him. I think Frank Warren did a great job, you know, in promoting him and letting the story gather momentum. So, yeah, you know, when you looked forward to it as a commentator, because they were kind of special nights with a bit of a tingle, and you knew it was going to be electric from Ricky 9 times out of 10.
Hey, when we talk about that, sorry.
I was just going to say it was fantastic theatre, Triz. You know, I was, while Ian was doing it on television, I was doing it on radio, and it was just an amazing acoustic sound experience as well as visual.
Yeah.
Because those ring walks were absolutely spine tingling. You got the blue moon booming out across MEN, and thousands standing up, joining in, singing along. It was party atmosphere, and Ricky loved those ring walks, and he got in the ring and he was the hero. He loved it. He loved the fact that he was carried along on this wave of emotion, and he delivered just wonderfully well in those early days. Yeah, he has sometimes could get overhyped. I think that was the case when he fought Eamon McGee. Eamon was an underrated fighter as well. But he got caught early, he got put down, didn't he? But came back and won the fight. He could sometimes get, I think, a little bit too carried away with it, Ricky. But he loved it, and he was Manchester's hero, and he became Britain's hero.
Ian, we're all quite grizzled at this, and we've seen you know, your Mayweathers, your Pacquiao's, your Roy Jones's, your Lennox's, and all the rest of it. But has there been an atmosphere that compares in boxing to a Ricky Hatton atmosphere for you?
I think I'd put the Ricky Hatton Costa Zhu atmosphere almost only Hagler Hearns of all the fights I covered in the 1985 middleweight classic, would I say, was the atmosphere more spine tingling than for Ricky Hatton against Costa Zhu, you know, which was his big night. I don't think anybody could have beaten him that night. He was that charged up, that fit. He would have, you know, he would have walked through walls to be world champion that night. And as good as you was, he wasn't going to beat Ricky Hatton, not on that night. And they'd worked out the tactics very well as well for that. But the feeling, you know, of watching him do it and achieve his dream was something extremely special. And I think I use the word Ricky Hatton, you know, when it was all over, Ricky Hatton rocks the world. And that's how you felt. He'd rocked the world. And, you know, I think the fight was on American television as well, and they loved him too, the other side of the Atlantic. And, you know, that's where the story kind of moved to in the later part of Ricky's career, and where, of course, he made an awful lot of money.
John, how about that? That
I remember,
MEN show. Yeah, go on.
I remember walking back from the MEN that night. I think I was probably with Duke McKenzie and whoever had been involved in the presentation and reporting and one or two producers, and I said, always remember that night, because in my experience, before and since, I don't think there's been a better night that I've been involved in. And I remember also saying, you know, whatever happens from here on, it's hard to believe that Ricky Hatton can actually be any better than he was tonight. It was just mesmerizing the whole night. Absolutely wonderful. Yes. And do you remember as well, Ian, we were staying in the same hotel. We went back to the Marriott, didn't we, down near the old Granada studios, and inevitably had the debrief over a few beers. And finally, Ricky Hatton wanders along and came into the bar and had a pint with us. And we're there standing at the bar, chatting away about what's happened, and people were coming in to breakfast.
Yeah. I mean, I used to make it a thing. I mean, you could call me a bit standoffish if you like, but I had a little bit of a thing about, you know, not becoming too matey-matey with the fighters that I covered, even though they were charming guys and a privilege and a pleasure to cover in the main. But I do think with Ricky, you know, we weren't big bosom buddies or anything like that, but we had a pretty good, amiable relationship just because he was that kind of guy. So maybe it was a little bit unprofessional, but when you watched him and you saw him have the kind of night he had with Kostyuzhu, with all his dreams coming true in front of all his adoring fans, that you felt it a little bit like you were his mate. And do you know what? I think everybody who watched that fight felt that same thing. He did make everybody feel like he was a bit of a mate of theirs.
And you guys had to prepare to deliver a commentary at, when was it, about 2 a.m, 3 a.m?
Yeah, it was about 2 a.m. because it was being shown live in America on Showtime, it would be. And there was I don't think I'd ever commentated at that sort of time in a UK fight, but goodness me, once you got going, the adrenaline kicked in and you completely forgot about what time it was. And what a dramatic fight. Do you remember when Kostyuzhu smacked Ricky in the nuts round about the seventh round? And we sort of thought, oh dear, what's going to happen here? You know, Zhu was really trying to turn it into a brawl, trying to soften him up in any way possible. And Ricky went out in the next round and replied in kind. Great left hand, smack between the legs.
Yeah. I mean, I think they worked out a very clever thing, didn't they, with that fight, because Zhu was regarded as one of the best pound-for-pound champions at that time. I think he was 35 by then, but he was still very, very good. And that right hand was the kind of punch that could change a contest, really, in a matter of seconds. They never got caught in that radar of the right hand, but they were either way away from it or way too close for Zhu to get the kind of leverage into the punch. And I think Billy Graham had worked that out particularly well, and that was a really good tactic on the night.
Yeah, of course. And it was a sensational night. I mean, John, where do you place that in terms of wins by a British fighter? Obviously, we've got, you know, Lennox and his big wins. We've got Lloyd Hannigan over Don Curry and all those. Where does Hatton and Kostyuzhu fit into the pantheon of great wins by British fighters?
Well, it's got to be right up there with the 2020 vision of hindsight. People will say, well, Kostyuzhu was there ready to be taken. He'd had a little bit of time out of the ring. He wasn't the fighter that he had been a year or two earlier. But it's always easy to say that when you know the outcome of the fight. People weren't saying that in the run-up to the fight. People were saying this is one of the great champions. And Kostyuzhu was a pretty nailed-on favourite to win it. So what Ricky did, And the manner in which he did it, remember that eventually he broke his heart. Zhu was beaten up and never came out for the last round. His trainer, Johnny Lewis, threw the towel in. That was it. But I think when you look back at it in those terms and try to remember what it was all about in the build-up and how much it was a step up in class for Ricky, his fights before that, he'd been fighting people like Ray Oliveira and Michael Stewart, you know, and who were they? You look back now and nobody remembers who on earth they were, but Kostyuzhu was one of the great names, and to go powering through as he did was sensational.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point you make how people try to reinvent history a little bit about great fights, because people say, you know, like when Lloyd Hannigan beat Don Curry, Don Curry was being raved about at the time as, you know, pound for pound king. Maybe he was a bit tight at the weight and that's why Hannigan blew him away in that fashion. Probably that somebody was trying to reinvent, you know, the story of how Randolph Turpin beat Sugar Ray Robinson. You could go through history. The fact is, you know, it's right in there, I'd say, in the top five ever British performances. You know, that's off the top of my head without kind of going through it all with a tooth comb.
I think that's Costa fair.
Costa Zunu, didn't he?
Yeah,
Costa Zunu. He was very gracious.
Yeah, he had the utmost respect for Ricky, didn't he? Afterwards and still years on, I think they've been reunited a couple of times since, and Costa Zunu's got nothing but respect. And I think it's easy to be revisionist as well, because obviously Costa Zunu never fought again. So we didn't know what he had left, because that was it. That was it as far as he was concerned.
He'd done it all by then, hadn't he? It was a good time for him to bow, and he'd made good money from the business.
Sure. Ian, let me ask you this. We had skipped over this, by the way. In 2002, you would have been there covering it when Ricky fought Stephen Smith. And that came to a rather inconspicuous end when Darkie Smith took to the ring. And it was Stephen Smith's dad who went in there to protest about an apparent elbow. I'm not sure if you remember that, John, if you've got that. Do you remember that? Darkie Smith going in and having a rumble in the ring?
Yeah.
I do remember him. Got to remember him getting up there. Yeah, I can remember thinking, what on earth is going on here? Yeah, he was unhappy about it, wasn't he? But Ricky was not always the most Corinthian in there. You know, he was capable of employing one or two slightly iffy tricks, shall we say?
Yeah, and he wouldn't be the first, though, would he?
No, that's true. That's true. But then after Costa Zoo, obviously Ricky left Frank, and he was signed up with Dennis Hobson, and then the American Dream. After he'd unified against Carlos Mauser with that booming left hook. The American Dream really took hold, and he fought Colazzo, Arango, and Castillo, all the lead up into we know where this is going. The Colazzo fight was really life and death, despite him flooring Colazzo early.
Welterweight, wasn't it? Proper welterweight, wasn't it, that fight in Boston?
That's right.
Rained all week. I remember that. I'll tell you what, that was close. That was close. We were wondering if he was going to get beaten there, and the American Dream was going to explode in his face. He struggled that night. Was that the fight? There was another fight, the one in Vegas against that guy with Juan Arango, where the mic caught Billy saying, and I thought, do you know what? I think Ricky was hurt by a body shot in that last round. And you caught the mic caught Billy saying to Ricky about the seventh round, just get through this, just get through this. Because so you had a sense there that was another hard labor night in Vegas.
Ricky was unwell going into that. I think Ricky had some sort of cold or flu going into that, and wasn't himself. And he had chill veins on his lips and stuff from where he'd struggled at the weight and different things. Sorry, John, I cut you off.
Yeah, you're right. I was just going to say precisely what you said. He had a nasty virus, and he got those cold sores on his face, and he really looked a bit of a mess. He was physically not in a good place for that fight. It was at the Paris Casino. Do you remember? And a lot of expectation that Ricky was going to deliver something sensational. And he proved it. Proved he was human that night, and he wasn't in the greatest of physical shape. And it was one which, as you heard from Billy, you know, just get through it. So let's just get this one out of the way and move on.
You remember the Paris Casino, John? You and I went we couldn't get a meal anywhere, and you and I went for a meal there, and we were served this disgusting piece of fish swimming in a green liquid, and you made your views very, very apparent to the waiter. Let's put it that way. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, sometimes meals in Vegas are very good. Sometimes in those big hotels, they can be utterly abysmal. And that was one of them. I still remember it sort of, I think my face was pretty much the same color as the sauce.
I can actually see. I can actually see a fish actually swimming around in green sauce now if I shut my eyes. But that Arango fight triggered three back-to-back fights in Vegas. And I mean, those Vegas trips, no one will ever forget those trips. Ricky Hatton in Vegas was a story within a story, really. But boxing became a microcosm of the Ricky Hatton story, because everyone and the world and their wife went to Vegas, and it's all anyone talked about.
But Tris, it's interesting, you know, because, I mean, the figure we were saying at the time was, we think there might be as many as 10,000 fans coming to support Ricky Hatton. I mean, as time's gone by, that figure's gone up to about 50,000. You know, every time I read it, it's more. But you're right. It was an extraordinary level of support. And of course, because of that, and Vegas being a money town and the economy being the big thing, they loved it. So, you know, Ricky Hatton being in town, yeah. Every time, we'll take it.
Well, there was all these stories of the bar. Yeah. Yeah.
They still talk about it to this day. You know, there's only one Ricky Hatton, Ricky Hatton walking along in a Hatton Wonderland.
Yes.
You know,
because they don't have singing in America. Fans don't sing songs like British fans do. So they were just absolutely charmed and fascinated by that. You know, walking along, singing a song, walking in a Hatton Wonderland or a Ricky Wonderland or whatever it was. But yeah, it was all quite a scene.
And then part of the scene, John, is this is where obviously the coverage of the fights really started changing. I'm not saying that Ricky sort of was the catalyst. I think it might have been the De La Hoya Mayweather fight, but you'll remember they threw open the weigh-ins, and this was all relatively new for boxing at the time. You know, people, thousands upon thousands, went to see the guys get on the scales.
Well, whether that was the plan beforehand, I really don't know, but there were so many Hatton fans over there, and they were making their presence so audibly known, and they're spending fortunes in the bars night after night. You know, I think it became very much a part of it. I remember at the time I was writing for the Guardian as well as commentating, and I did a breakdown on the fight, and Ricky and his team were not at all happy with what I wrote, because I basically went through every facet of the fight and pretty much in every division gave the advantage to Mayweather, and I basically said, look, Ricky's going to have to produce the fight of his life round after round after round if he's going to win this one, because technically and from a sheer skill point of view, Mayweather is the man.
Ian, what was your thought process? What was your thought going into that, Ian?
I thought Mayweather would win, because nearly every fight with Mayweather, I still think he was a great fighter who was never really in a great fight, but that wasn't his fault. He was just way too good technically. He was the defensive master. He could negate every opponent in front of him. He just knew how to beat opponents. And that's what he did for his whole career. So I didn't really think Ricky coming out in at him, trying to wing away with those hooks, I thought he'd have the answers. Particularly at that stage, because we'd seen Ricky have the struggle with Colazzo and to a lesser extent Arango as well. So maybe he wasn't ever quite where he was, you know, around the time of the Costa-Zu fight. But let me tell you something financially for Ricky around that fight, and somebody can ring in and correct my figures if they're wrong, but this is how I kind of understand it. It was a pay-per-view fight in the middle of the night on Sky Sports. And I understand it. The deal that Sky did with Ricky was they didn't think it'd do fantastic business. They thought it'd do well. So the deal was Sky got most of the money for the first 400,000 sales. Ricky'd get something like 5 or 10% of that. Okay. Anything above 400,000, Ricky got 75, 80%, I think it was. It did 1.15 million at 4 o'clock in the morning. So work it out for yourself how much money Ricky Hatton made out of that fight alone. So it was, and that's quite apart from anything from the American side of it. So, I mean, good luck to him. Good luck to any fighter who can make that kind of money. And he made that kind of money because he could sell a fight and he was a marquee fighter. So great for Ricky. And, you know, it's something I hope he can live happily ever after on.
I will never forget that night, because I was unfortunately stapled to a toilet in Basel, Switzerland, having watched Wayne Elcock get mullered by Arthur Abraham and having food poisoning out there. And it was my first away trip for Boxing News since I joined the staff. And the night before, I went and had a dodgy spaghetti in Switzerland. And the entire day, I was messaging the Sauerland PR people saying, I don't think I can make it. I'm literally can't move more than 10 feet from the room. Anyway, I somehow managed to feel better, went out, covered the fights, got back, and then felt worse again and managed to watch Ricky from peering around the corner of the bathroom unfortunately lose to Floyd Mayweather, which I remember at the time as well. Claude had gone out to cover the fight for Boxing News, and I was left to run the show, and I used the headline England expects on the cover of Boxing News, and Claude messaged me and said, what did you think of the issue? He said, well, expects is a bit rich. He said, maybe hopes should have been a better word. Yeah. Which I kind of get. One thing we're skipping, by the way, here with the Mayweather thing is the fight before, he'd sawn Jose Luis Castillo in half, hadn't he, at the Thomas and Mack? And that was certainly one of his stronger performances, even if you say Castillo was beyond his best by that point.
Mm. Oh, the punch he landed, I did that fight. I think that was a Satanta fight, wasn't it? And I covered that fight, and that left hook he threw in the fourth round, it nearly went through Castillo. It was a phenomenal punch. There were people there at ringside saying, oh, has he quit? Has he swallowed? No, I don't think so. I don't think Ricky ever threw a more perfect left hook than the one which he detonated on Castillo, and the bloke was never going to get up from it.
And that helped to sell the Mayweather fight, didn't it, in America a bit better than the Urango and the Colazzo performances. Well,
and Ricky called Mayweather out, didn't he, afterwards, in the ring afterwards. He was saying something about there was more entertainment in my four rounds than Mayweather's whole career or whatever it was.
Yeah, he was good at the press conference and all the build-up. Ricky was full of his usual one-liners. I think another one was, you know, Floyd, you know, if there was reincarnation, he'd come back as himself, wouldn't he? You know, stuff like that. I mean, he did get under his skin a little bit. But I remember walking, I think, to the weigh-in. We were walking to the weigh-in, and for some reason, Mayweather's people were right behind us, including him. And Mayweather was walking along singing that song. Walking along, singing a song. How extraordinary. But one thing he wasn't was worried.
Hey, Ian, wasn't it when Ricky did a press conference over here with Floyd and Floyd wore the Manchester United shirt? Wasn't that something that was live on Sky Sports News? I don't know if you were part of this. And Ricky was F-bombing all the way through it, not realizing he was live on Sky. And I think every second word was a swear word.
Yeah. That was another great scene in Manchester, really. Like, you know, when Tyson went there and was hanging out the hotel window and there were kind of thousands of people in the square ahead of him. So yeah, I mean, they thought it was a smart move to wear a Manchester United shirt. Not sure really it was.
So, John, to the Mayweather fight, obviously there was this thing with Joe Cortez and his encroachment in the fight. Ricky obviously thought it was partly because, well, I say obviously, it's not obvious, but he thought it was in part because the British fans booed the national anthem. So he thought that got Cortez's back up. But, John, what was your take on the infringing Joe Cortez?
Well, he clearly wasn't prepared to allow Ricky to turn it into some sort of barroom brawl. He was on his case from very early in the fight, eventually deducting a point, probably wrongly, but he was reacting to Ricky's tactics from word go. So Ricky thought afterwards, and I think his whole team thought afterwards, that with Cortez acting in the manner that he has, Ricky wasn't able to fight his fight, if you take what I mean. Lennox Lewis had said in the run-up to the fight, if Ricky's going to win this one, he's got to go out there and absolutely blitz him early in those first four rounds. Now, whether or not Ricky tried to do that, he certainly wasn't allowed to do that because Joe Cortez wasn't allowing him to get into the pocket, to get in close and land those trademark hooks. So he almost felt perhaps with a little bit of justification, that he was up against two men on the night.
Tris, I think you made a good point. That booing of the American national anthem, they're very proud of their flag and their national anthem. And the booing was really bad by the big British contingent there. And that definitely did have an effect on Cortes. You could see that as it was happening, and there was an American guy, as we were standing up at ringside, the anthem was playing, who leant over to me and said, I hope your guy has the shit kicked out of him, you know. And I said, he's not my guy. I'm just commentating on the fight. Anyway, now that was the kind of strength of feeling. And I do think it didn't help Ricky one bit. And it was ridiculous, really, of the British fans to do that. I think we said so as well on the
It's toxic
enough at Wembley, haven't we, at football internationals? You know, you just have to respect the other national anthem. So that was bad of the British fans, and they probably had a few drinks all day, and they thought that was the right way to react. It wasn't. It didn't help Ricky at all. But yeah, Cortes didn't let Ricky fight his fight. There's no doubt about that. He was on the case. He was helping Mayweather no end. But did it affect the result? No.
Did you two drink yourselves, or did you guys help drink Las Vegas dry after that?
I don't remember the huge drinking out there, because we're, you know, Ian and I, we like the odd glass here and there, but we're fairly modest in the way that we approach it, aren't we, Darkie?
Yeah, we're pathetic, really.
Pair of lightweights.
I don't think I've ever drunk anywhere completely dry. I mean, a bit more my style at the in my dotage, I think, was, you know, we'd go and have a grilled salmon and some green beans and a glass of wine somewhere quiet if we could find it. So, you know, I always used to book a little restaurant before all the crowd got into town, so that we could just go there once we'd finished the fight and sit in a corner and have a good chat and a few glasses of wine and something hopefully nice to eat that wasn't swimming in any kind of green liquid.
In terms of going back to the origin story of Ricky, I mean, it's an amazing platform, isn't it? When Ricky, this kid from a council estate in Hattersley, and Billy, this sort of a battle-worn trainer from Salford, two huge underdogs really in life, I suppose, given their starts, atop in the bill in Las Vegas, name up in lights, everyone wanting a piece of them, doors opening for them left, right, and center. And obviously, you know, people in the entourage and camps vicariously living through their success. It's amazing how Las Vegas turns on its head for these people, isn't it? I always remember that with Amir Khan as well. And I know Amir Khan turned pro with a little bit more fanfare. But these guys from humble origins in Bolton and Amir's case, the red carpet is rolled out for these guys, isn't it? When they're topping the bill in Las Vegas, it must be very hard for them to take it in their stride, if you will, Darkie.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. But I think Ricky coped well with stardom, didn't he? I think he liked being a star. He embraced it, and he knew how to perform for his public, and he relished the show as well, just as we relished watching him. So, you know, it was a kind of sad, though, really, you know, what happened afterwards. There's kind of shades of the Naz story, isn't there, with Ricky? Like, he wasn't with Billy Graham, you know, for those later fights, and that was sad. And then, you know, there was the problems between him and his parents and the family, and so many boxing stories are like that. I mean, it was such a lovely, warm story, and it became tinged with bitterness, you know.
And of course,
he had later in after his career.
And, of course, he let himself get out of shape so badly between fights, didn't he? He always did that to an extent and was able to get away with it when he was younger. But as the years ticked by, he found it harder and harder to get down to the weight, having to lose something like 2 to 3 stones, maybe even more than that. And to get down, put it into context, that's losing 25% of your body weight, maybe in the space of a couple of months or a little bit more, to get down and have a huge fight. I mean, that's a ruinous thing for any fighter to do. Some have got away with it in, you know, back in the mists of time. But more recently, I don't think there's anybody who's
perhaps really abuse themselves quite as badly as Ricky did. And ultimately, it took its toll and massively shortened his career, which is a shame.
Yeah, I mean, they weren't just binges, were they? They were spectacular binges. And when we had stories of him drinking, you know, not just sort of five or six pints, it'd be up near a 20 pints, you know, of Guinness, that kind of thing. Maybe some other drinks mixed in. It'd be Greasy Spoon. But I remember Ricky saying once when we asked him about this, you know, can you afford to keep doing this? You know, you haven't, the first week or two, you go back to the gym. It's just a question of getting the weight off before you can get on with the job of actually preparing for any specific fight. And he said, I can't do this unless I have that binge in between. I can't live this monastic regime that you need to be a fighter unless I have that letdown period in between fights. So I think once he did go back in the gym, he was pretty good. You know, he lived the life then, but my goodness me, he really did let go once it was over.
I saw Tony Jeffries tweet about this yesterday, actually, in terms of fighters blowing up in weight. It was quite an unhealthy precedent that Ricky was setting in terms of that became a bit of a normal thing for fighters to do. I think people thought it was feast or famine. And in many ways, you know, that became the norm for people. And obviously now you hear about guys having four round fights, having training camps, and as opposed to in the old days where people were in the gym learning their craft year round. And I think Ricky did there was set a dangerous precedent, because that's probably not the way to live. Even if, like you said, he had his own, there's different ways to switch off without having to punish your body in that way. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I know Ricky regrets it now. You know, that's something I heard saw him say in a recent interview. He regrets putting his body through that. And I think when we did the sums for War and Peace, I think we figured out he'd lost between 45 and 50 stone in his career.
Oh, wow. That's incredible, isn't it?
I mean, statistic.
John hit the nail on the head, and you too, Tris. You can do that maybe when you're 22 and get away with it, but not when you get to sort of 28, 30.
Yeah. So he had that homecoming fight with Juan Lascano in the City of Manchester Stadium. I think that was the last one with Billy. And then he had this weird marriage, didn't he, with Floyd Mayweather Sr., which of all the people you thought he was going to go to, I didn't see that one coming. John, did you see them working together at all, Floyd Sr. and Ricky?
No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I've not been at Roots together, you know, in preparation. So I can't that with all honesty. And so coming fight, I think the things were going wrong. I remember him getting nailed in about the eighth or ninth round, and he really was wobbled. And you looked at it and you sort of thought, well, the Ricky of old against a fairly unexceptional fighter wouldn't have been in trouble like that. And I think from there on, things were starting to go wrong. And we alluded to the lifestyle and the toll it took. When he finally got in there against Manny Pacquiao, he looked like a dead man walking, didn't he? He looked absolutely dreadful in the run-up to that fight. Had clearly drained himself to get down to the weight. And it was almost painful. Well, it was obviously painful for him, but it was painful to watch when you remembered what a fighter he'd been. And there was an element of you watching it thinking, you've done this to yourself.
Yeah, well, the Floyd Mayweather Senior thing was bizarre. I just think they were so much on completely different wavelengths. You know, when you think of how close he'd been with Billy and how they spoke the same language. I mean, Floyd Mayweather Sr. might have been from the planet Mars, really, as far as Ricky was concerned. I don't think it was ever going to work, and it didn't either.
Yeah, well, there was a false economy because he looked decent against Malignaggi, but obviously then it was the Pacquiao camp, and I think everything went wrong to that. There were stories about Ricky getting hurt by Arislandi Lara and maybe other sparring partners. And then there was talk of him pulling out, and he didn't. And then obviously what happened. Ian, did you covered that fight, the Pacquiao fight?
Yeah, do you know what? And I'm going to be honest here. We're speaking a few years later. I thought Ricky was dead when he took that punch, and he lay there almost as if he was laying in a coffin. It was a horrible thought. You could not articulate that on air, but I was really, really worried. And I remember too the piercing scream of Jennifer, his partner at ringside. You know, a horrible scream that kind of went right through you, which there was, just for a few seconds, like a real sense of doom. And to watch him there like that, and you're thinking, he can't ever surely fight again. You never come back from being knocked out like that. Now, thank goodness he you know, we were wrong. He did get up from it, but it was chilling.
You know, Ian, you've articulated my thoughts exactly when it happened to Pacquiao, and I was there against Marquez, and Marquez stuck him with that terrific right hand, and Pacquiao dropped face first. It's strange because you see these guys, Pacquiao and Hatton, bursting with life, waving to the crowd, and all the rest of it, and all of a sudden they're the completely opposite, completely still, and the worst things possible go through your mind. John, a sad night though for British boxing, wasn't it? It was really the end of an era, because we all knew that the Ricky Hatton ride was over at that level with that Pacquiao destruction, didn't we?
Yeah, it was the end of the road, and what a fantastic journey it had been. We'd all of us loved going through the fights, going through the years, watching the story, and it was sad the way it ultimately unraveled. But I suppose when you look back, at least the final moment came. Okay, he came back in 2012, didn't he, and have that final fight against Vyacheslav Zinchenko. In a rather ill-fated comeback attempt. But to lose to a fighter of the stature of Manny Pacquiao, I suppose there's some sort of little bit of credit to come out of that. If you're going to lose, at least lose to a terrific fighter, which Ricky did.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at his career, okay, yeah, there was Zinchenko loss at the end there, which you can kind of discount, but he went through a great career from which he made a lot of money and became massively popular. And he can say, well, apart from that farewell defeat, he only lost to Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. So that wasn't bad, was it?
And I think the thing about that Zinchenko defeat as well is that actually it might have damaged his career to an extent, you know, when you talk about that third loss, but it gave him closure and peace of mind, which he'd struggled with so badly for 3 years. And I actually think, you know, because I was spending a lot of time with Ricky at the time, I actually thought that was an invaluable experience for him, as hurtful as it was. And when we talk about atmospheres, I've not been in a more shocking atmosphere, I don't think, than seeing Ricky Hatton get stopped by a body shot in the Manchester Arena, where the whole place just went, you could hear a pin drop. It was a shocking night, but Ricky was not upbeat afterwards, but I think he had the closure he was after. And I think that it served its purpose.
I think it's a good point, Tris. I remember him saying ahead of that fight, I'm going to retire happy either way round, because I know I gave it one last go to find out. Well, he did find out that it really was over.
Yeah.
And the fans were there in such huge numbers yet again, as they'd always had been, weren't they? They sold it out. Manchester dreamed that their hero could do it one more time. But of course, it never happened.
Yeah, he was 34 by then, you know, and he'd been on the go since he was 18, as you said, John. Well, before the amateurs, of course.
And that fighting style doesn't last for long. John, how about this? Obviously, Ricky was then on the front of the news of the world, and there was this stuff about, you know, we've mentioned it in the Joe Calzaghe episode, you know, with drugs and different things and depression and suicide. I mean, of all the people that you didn't think would succumb to it, and I know we've touched upon, he had plenty going on outside the ring. He was in many ways the last person you'd think of struggling like that, right?
Well, you would, but the nature of depression, I've had that in my family, so I know a fair bit about it, and I've also come into contact with people who've suffered from addiction, and it's not necessarily as straightforward as you think. It's not always the person who's hail fellow well met who can't suffer from depression. And I think when you've been at the level that Ricky was, with the adulation that was around him, when that all ends and the cameras turn off and the thousands are no longer there, you don't find the adrenaline rush that boxing produces easily. And I think that, yeah, he did go into free fall, and he went into some dark places. And I think the friendship which he now has with Tyson Fury is probably born to a significant extent out of the shared experiences of when they went into the downward spiral and how you get out of it. You know, in recent months, he was preparing for that comeback fight against Marco Antonio Barrera, and he's got himself into amazing shape. And I don't think he couldn't have been able to do that had he still been abusing himself as he had in years gone by. So if he's come through at the end of the tunnel, then I'm very, very pleased to see it, because I always, always liked Ricky a lot. And to see him on the front page of the papers snorting coke and in a pretty awful state was very, very hard to take.
Yeah, it was. It was painful. It was hurtful to see it. I think, you know, we all have a lot of reverence, really, for Ricky and what he did in the ring. And, you know, when you've been that big a star that, you know, you're headlining, your name's up in lights in Las Vegas, you're making millions and thousands of people are traveling the Atlantic to see you. It's a long way down from there, a long, long way down. And I think he was in a pit of despair and of drugs for a long time. I'm really, really glad that he appears to have come out the other side of all that.
Yeah, we've talked about this before, John, but depression in sport, it's absolutely no joke, is it? And do you think a big part of it is the loss of the adulation of the fans, or do you think it's the loss of the routine? Is there anything that you can pinpoint? Or in Ricky's case, was it just the loss of the buzz and him searching for that buzz of Hat in Wonderland and Blue Moon, you know, playing in front of thousands of people? How do you replace that?
I think it's different things in different cases. I don't think there's one hard and fast rule in this. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Frank Bruno, when he started to unravel when his career was over, I think in Frank's case, the biggest problem he had was the loss of routine, having George Francis telling him, right, you'll be here at such and such a time, we'll do this, we'll do that. And Frank loved working out, loved getting himself into shape, living the life, having the body of an Adonis. And when the eyes went and he could no longer fight, that, of course, is when he started to unravel. But in Ricky's case, I think more than anything, it was the adulation and the stardom. Old singers, you know, if you headline in Las Vegas, your voice might not be quite what it was in years gone by, but you can go on into declining years and people will still turn up to watch. Old fighters, people don't want, well, they might want to know them, but they don't want to see them particularly, and they certainly don't want to see them fight. So it's a very, very difficult thing to replace. And in Ricky's case, I don't think the adulation gets much bigger than what he had in his prime.
I did an interview once with Sugar Ray Leonard, I remember, and asked him why he was coming back. I said, is it ego, glamour, money? What is it? He said, all three. So I think, you know, that's why fighters can't replace that adrenaline. You know, suddenly the TV crews aren't turning up anymore. The writers aren't on the phone wanting quotes from you. The invites stop. I don't think any of us have been there, have we? We don't know. And I'm just glad that Ricky now, I think, has got his act back together again. And I hope things are okay. I know he went through a very long, difficult period with the family.
Yeah,
it's
and
good
I
to
think
see that.
Yeah, go on, John.
It's good to see that Paul Speak was always there alongside him, and is still alongside him to this day. The old retired police sergeant who became his. Well, sort of personal manager, confidant, mate. And I think Paul sticking with him and helping him forge a new career in whatever direction Ricky chose to go, I think that was a big help to him.
And there was that lad he used to bring in the ring with him. Do you remember James? Was it James Bowers? He used to climb the ring with Ricky, like his almost like his mascot, wasn't he? And, you know, that was...
I remember...
That endeared you to the camp as well.
Yeah, so there's a couple of bits on that. I mean, obviously, Ricky has subsequently patched things up with his parents, which is great, and he patched things up with Billy. So, you know, I think that's all given him a lot clearer vision moving forwards. And Ian, you mentioned there about people going around or being the press in demand. I remember Ed Robinson, your Sky colleague for years, telling me once in Ricky's years of coming up, Ed pulled up to Ricky's house once, and Ricky was just going out to get something from the shops. And Ricky tossed Ed Robinson the keys to the house and said, "Oh, let yourself in and go and put the kettle on."
Yeah, that's him, isn't it? Right.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, who would do that? I mean, I recorded Boxing Life Stories with Ricky last year, or coming out of the pandemic, and he did the same thing for me. He gave me the key at his gym and said, "Oh, go around the house and go and set up, and I'll be over there when you're ready." Which is great. I mean, John made that parallel there with Frank and saying that it's slightly different, but in terms of popularity, are Frank and Ricky out on their own, or is Tyson Fury now up with them?
Tyson Fury is getting close, isn't he? I think he kind of has that crossover appeal now, Tyson. There are still people who are prejudiced against him, I think, and don't like him because of what he let himself become when he was in that downward spiral. But I think there's been a massive respect for Tyson as a result of him putting his life together again. And I think that, you know, everybody still talks about that ITV documentary and he just sort of passed the time of day with him. And then the lad walks off and Tyson thinks to himself, that lad's got problems. And he called him back and gets talking to him and finds out that, yes, indeed, he does have mental problems. And I think people have warmed to Tyson for that reason. So I think Tyson's got a massive following now. I don't think it's quite up there as Ricky was in his prime, or indeed Frank Bruno as his prime, but he is hugely popular.
Yeah, I'd say that the top four in my time covering boxing for British fighters' popularity, not in any particular order, would be Henry Cooper, Frank Bruno, Ricky and Barry McGuigan. And obviously Tyson Fury is joining that party by the sounds of things.
Interesting. No room for Joshua just at the moment.
Oh, well, did I leave him out?
Yeah.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, is there a little bit of a perception with AJ at the moment that he sold enough tickets, hasn't he? But maybe that he's just damaged goods and has something to prove.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. And I think that the hand stuff is great. And I mean, the thing is, I'd be loath to say we'll never see one of those or his like again, but we'll be hard pushed, won't we, to ever have another story in our generation like a Ricky Hatton story, Ian, surely. Like, we've not seen this before. And I just can't see anyone taking over Vegas or doing anything similar to that. In the way that he did.
No, you'd need a vivid imagination to see that all unfolding again. But never say never, because this business happily continues to delight us and cause surprises. So maybe somebody's just lurking around the corner to give us that, because who'd have thought, you know, anybody would be as popular as Frank Bruno again or Henry again, you know? So, yeah, hope so.
But John, only one Ricky Hatton, right?
Well, he was an amazing story, and he was the ordinary lad made good. He was somebody who the bloke down the pub, the bloke in the street thinks, yeah, if I met him, if I met him, I would really get on with him. And everybody really empathized with him, and they took delight in seeing him doing so well, because boxing's like that, isn't it? We all live our lives a little bit vicariously. You kind of wish, there's something inside you that wishes you could be that man, that you could be a champion. And I think to the boxing public of that time, particularly the people of Manchester, they just saw him as one of their own. And I think so many lads sort of thought, good on you, because I'd have loved to have done that. I would have loved to have done what you've done. And you deserve every bit of success that's coming your way.
Mm. Now, maybe he was walking in a Ricky Wonderland after all. When all is said and done, he's come through the problems, and maybe he is again now.
Great stuff. Well, gents, this has been a great look back over the career of Ricky Hatton and some of your great anecdotes and some of the stories of your nights in Las Vegas. I still can't get over the fish swimming in the green sort of goo, but
that's gross. Absolutely gross.
Yeah. The waiters hopefully never got over it, I can tell you that.
I'm guessing they didn't have repeat business there, John.
I've never been back. I'm sure they've got different chefs, different waiters, but I've never set foot in that restaurant again.
Guard for life. Brilliant. Okay, well, gents, it's been an absolute pleasure as always, and we'll be back soon.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for the sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire who are supporting our podcast. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any vehicle you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal, and you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Check them out at fleetuk.com.